So I studied mathematics as an undergraduate at Princeton, but I'm actually a neurologist, which probably most people here don't know. And actually, for 15 years, was attending a month a year at Harlem Hospital, just to give you an idea of my perspective. So here is a this is called ECOG, or electrocorticography data, from a child with a frontal cortical dysplasia, or subcortical dysplasia. Is this the pointer? No. Well, I'll use the mouse. Oh, this one. This one here. The green one?
I think it should be the green one, yeah.
Okay, never mind. So, imagine a flat grid about so big, a little smaller maybe, with a 4x6 or 6x8 array of electrodes that are a centimeter apart, and this is laid over the surface of the brain to record seizures. And this child, this was a 14-month-old child. She had previously had an MRI. There was from scalp EEG, and from the clinical pattern of the seizures, it all fit with a focal seizure with secondary generalization from somewhere around here. And the point of the invasive recording was to confirm that all of her seizures actually began where people thought they began, which would be useful in doing surgery. And the reason for showing this is to illustrate some of the components that occur during actual seizures in patients and to emphasize some of the complexities. So in this was part of a series of children with cortical dysplasias, and all of these children and all of their seizures, they began with this, what we call VFO, or very fast oscillation, in just a few of the electrodes, namely these three. It looks sort of like a thickening of the line at this temporal resolution. And if you expand it with better signal-to-noise ratio, you see this kind of low amplitude oscillation. This is about 70, 80, 90 hertz in this case. And then that would evolve for a few seconds, this time scale is 1 second, and then start to increase in amplitude, and these larger amplitude, slower discharges would begin to occur, and over a much wider spatial area than the original VFO. And this is an example of one of the seizure bursts, and if you look at it carefully, you actually can see that there's very fast oscillation superimposed on this burst. And then this patient also had so-called interictal spikes, which look like this kind of potential, but in isolation, not part of a seizure. And you saw the same temporal correlation of the very fast oscillation and this thing, which lasts tens of milliseconds. So there, in trying to understand this, we have a number of difficulties. One is we have to be able to separate the different components and try to study them one by one. So it turns out that there are in vitro models of this, and there are in vitro models of this, which are reasonably understood. Then the question is, what is the relationship between the fast oscillation, if any, and these kinds of bursts? Now, another kind of complexity is that, although this is clearly pathological, the association of very fast oscillations and waves that last tens of milliseconds, this also occurs normally during physiological sharp waves in the hippocampus, which were discovered in the 1980s and very nicely reviewed by Bujaki in 1986 or so. And then in a science paper from the Bujaki lab in 1991, 92, it was shown that these ripples, so-called ripples, 200 hertz oscillations, occurred superimposed on these events that look very much like that, only normally. And not only is it a normal phenomenon, but it appears that that rippling oscillations, when they do occur normally, encode information. So that the pattern of firing of cells in the hippocampus in an exploring rat you know, you would see, as the rat walks along, you'd see this cell fire, and then this cell fire, and then this cell fire, over a period of seconds, that is replayed during an event like this, which maybe lasts 100 milliseconds, but it's all time compressed. So this makes you worry, or it should make you worry. How is it that a phenomenon like that can occur normally, seem to have something to do with information processing, and yet also occur as a prelude to a seizure, as a biomarker of a seizure, and during a seizure? I'm not going to answer that question. I just want to raise it. Now, so as I said, we need to separate the fast, the rippling components, and the burst components, at least to begin with. And this was the paper that was the clue, at least for my thinking, about how to look at rippling types of oscillations. So the Bujaki lab had described in vivo the superimposition of a ripple on top of a sharp wave. And what Andreas Dragoon discovered by accident was that it was possible to demonstrate a ripple without a sharp wave. And this was done in vitro in calcium-free conditions. So the chemical synaptic transmission was completely blocked, and yet nevertheless you saw these field potential oscillations at about 200 hertz. So what produces the oscillations? So other kinds of data, when people record from axons, they don't see individual axons firing at 200 hertz, although I have to admit there's not very much data of that sort in low calcium, or maybe there's no data of that sort. But generally, isolated axons don't discharge at these frequencies. So this appears to be a network, a population phenomenon, and you can confirm that by recording in the slice with two electrodes that are several hundred microns apart and see very tight coupling of these ripples. So what is it that is generating this emergent phenomenon? And one thing that was suggested, especially because these experiments were done in John Jeffrey's lab in Birmingham, UK, was maybe the cells were synchronized by so-called field effects or currents that flow in the extracellular medium. And I submit that that is extremely implausible if you look at the voltage scale, which is tens of microvolts. So that only left gap junctions, at least the only plausible possibility we could think of was gap junctions. Now, for reasons that I'll show later, gap junction pharmacology is very dirty. There's a reason for that. But so in this paper, a number of different dirty drugs were used, like the anesthetic halothane, but they're all dirty in different ways. So in the intersection of the effects, or at least of the known effects of all of these agents, like halothane and octanol and carbonoxolone, was blocking of gap junctions, and all of them would suppress this kind of activity. Now, in addition, pH is known to modulate the conductance of gap junctions. So experimentally, you can manipulate pH, and you can show that if you alkalinize the medium, which at least for most gap junctions increases their conductance, then the amplitude of this activity would increase. So somehow, this is generated by gap junctions, not by chemical synapses, and the question is how? How does it come about? So that's not a trivial question, and I'll come back to it. So this is Bob Wong, who is one of my collaborators since the 1970s, and I was showing his picture because I wanted to tell you something about the intrinsic properties of CA3 pyramidal cells, which was going to lead into how is it that you get a synchronized burst in vitro under certain experimental conditions. But I think in the interest of time, I'm going to have to pass over this and just summarize it in a few sentences. The way that you get intrinsic bursts in single pyramidal cells, or CA3 pyramidal cells, is through an interaction between slow dendritic calcium-mediated currents and faster perisomatic sodium currents, generating action potentials that so-called backpropagate into the dendrites. And it's the interaction between these kinds of electrogenesis on different time scales that leads to bursting behavior like this. And this was proposed in the late 1970s, a long time ago, And the basic idea has been confirmed experimentally with much more advanced technology many times, using patch clamp recording in visualized cells, which was developed later by Nair and Zachman, and this is from the Zachman lab. So this is simultaneous recording from soma and dendrites and isolating the dendritic activity slow and like this, and the fast spikes coming from the soma. Okay, so you have to take my word for it. I don't want to go into the details. Another picture from the Zachman lab. So let us assume that individual pyramidal cells, of at least certain types of pyramidal cells, can generate intrinsic bursts, which means by themselves, if they're at the right level of membrane potential, and they can just do it. Now the problem is during an experimental model of an interictal spike, all of the cells, or many of the cells in a piece of tissue, will generate bursts together. And we see this in humans, we see it in experimental animals, we see it in vitro. And this is what it looks like in a hippocampal slice. So this kind of event, this is a local field potential. It's so-called comb-shaped, C-O-M-B, like comb-shaped, because you can see the envelope lasting tens of milliseconds and then the high-frequency ripple on top of it. Very like a normal physiological sharp wave, which had not been described at this time. So a little history: the slice preparation was developed to do biochemistry in the liver, and it was adapted to do electrophysiology in brain by Yamamoto in Japan, and picked up by Per Andersen in Norway. And a guy named Phil Schwarzkroin went to Norway, did a postdoc with him, learned the technique, brought it back to Stanford, where he was working with a very famous epilepsy researcher who was mentioned earlier today, I think, named David Prince. Maybe Yvonne mentioned him. So they started studying interictal bursts in hippocampal slices bathed in penicillin, which turns out to be a weak GABA-A blocker. And there's a very interesting history that goes along with that, which I'll have to skip, how that was discovered. So in any case, how does this synchronization come about? So one important step in understanding that was in 1981, when Dan Johnston and Tom Brown started doing intracellular recordings from pyramidal cells during events like this, and they estimated the synaptic conductance that was developed during such an event. And they estimated that it was several hundred nanosiemens. So an individual conductance produced by a single EPSC was of the order of one nanosiemen. So what that suggested was, you know, what we already knew. All the cells are bursting, they're all firing at high frequencies, there are recurrent connections. This has been known since the 19th century. And so the cells are all exciting each other, and they're making this massive excitatory synaptic input. What wasn't known was what makes them get their act together, and how can we understand that? And the clue, at least for this part of the brain in these conditions, came from Bob Wong, who found that he could evoke these events with a tiny stimulus. He would puff out a little bit of hypertonic potassium at this point, and then see what appeared to be nothing happening for tens of milliseconds or even hundreds of milliseconds, and then bang, this thing would go off. And if he looked in single cells, if you take this one, this is a cell that's been really hyperpolarized, so it can't fire, and it unmasked this huge EPSP. This is what Johnston and Brown were seeing. If you don't hyperpolarize it, you see the latent period, and then a burst. Every now and then he would find a cell which would do this, which would make an early burst. And that gave a clue for understanding sort of simple physical principles which were underlying this. And that involved not weak coupling between cells, but very strong coupling. So the analogy would be to a fission bomb where you have, a uranium nucleus, and it spontaneously splits and emits some energetic neutrons, and they induce fissions and other nuclei, and then you get a chain reaction and everything goes. So of course it takes some time between the first fission and the explosion, because you have a buildup, an exponential buildup of activity. So that's an example of strong coupling, and it depends on this. Each fission has to induce more than one other fission, and a single fission, when it does cause another fission, one's presynaptic, if you will, fission is sufficient. So what we would propose, or what we did propose, was that bursting of spikes can propagate from a single neuron to a single other neuron. And this is something that people had not thought of at that time. You realize this is 30 years ago. It was known that there were huge synaptic potentials in the cerebellum at climbing fiber synapses. So if you stimulate a single inferior olivary neuron and you look at a Purkinje cell that it innervates, you see an enormous, enormous EPSP. But the idea that pyramidal cells would interact with each other in this way seemed very odd. And why was it odd? It was odd for a reason, because if you look at pyramidal cells, they're just studded with spines. There are, you know, thousands of them. So each cell has a very large number of inputs from other cells. And if it was the case that each one of those inputs was very strong, the cell, you would think, would just be overloaded. It would be incapable of doing so-called synaptic integration, which is how we think the brain is computing. So this was one of those hypotheses that people said had to be wrong. And I'm not exaggerating too much. So in any case, the model was based on these two properties. How the cells generated bursts was not relevant for these purposes. The relevant thing was that there was this exponential buildup, the huge conductance would develop, and it was possible to account for this latency by the time it would take for bursting in one cell to propagate to one other cell, and the connectivity, both of which can be measured. So Richard Miles, this is a more recent picture of him, but you have to picture what Richard Miles looked like in the early 1980s when he had more hair and his hair was bright red. And he didn't wear glasses. But otherwise, it was still Richard. He was the same person. And he's still Richard now. So what Richard did was he recorded from pairs of pyramidal cells in this region, CA3, and here's an example, cell 1, cell 2. Cell 1 fires, makes an EPSP, makes a burst, makes a big EPSP, and then he saw this. So it turns out that if the membrane potential in this cell, cell 2, is about right, then bursting does propagate from cell to cell, and the latency is roughly 10 milliseconds. It's about 10 to 25 milliseconds. And that is sufficient to account for the time of buildup of this activity. Yes, it's from this to this. First spike to first spike. And Richard also, again, people do this routinely now. He recorded from over 1,000 pairs of pyramidal cells. That was a big deal back then. It was done blindly with sharp electrodes. And so he could also estimate the connectivity, and he could show that on average, each cell would contact more than one other. So the other prediction of this model, this crazy model, was that if you stimulate one neuron, one pyramidal cell, you should be able to set off the population. And Richard and Bob Wong also demonstrated that. Here's an example of a current evoked burst in cell one, and it makes the population go. This is the field. And here's another cell chosen, and it bursts in phase with this cell. So, okay, this is a very simple picture of how you can get synchronization, at least in the CA3 region, and under special condition being disinhibition. Now, is this account generally valid? So to be generally valid, it would be, what about the entorhinal cortex? What about neocortex? What about if you don't have disinhibition? So I just want to show a little bit of data about that the point of which is this is a very complicated and non-trivial area to investigate. So this is a paper by Williams and Stewart. Greg Stewart was trained by Sachmann, and they looked at pairs of synaptically coupled layer 5 pyramidal neurons, and they would make the soma burst by passing a current. And then this is recording from the axon, and it shows that each somatic spike makes an axonal spike. So that's nice to know. It means you do have a signal propagating down. And then they looked at induced synaptic potentials in other cells, connected cells. They didn't describe bursting at all in these connected cells. So it was a negative result, although on the other hand, they weren't looking for bursting. The point of the paper was something else. Now, this is an author that Erin mentioned and acknowledged at the end of her talk, Wang. And this paper has not gotten the attention I think it deserves. So these, as she said, these are two nearby layer 5 pyramidal cells. And you can see them here, cell 1, cell 2. And notice that by light microscopy, these cells, the axons sort of kiss each other, and you can even see the sites of contact here. Of course, you don't know ultrastructurally what's going on there. I mean, I have very good eyes, and I can see gap junctions there, but nobody else has seen them. Now, so here, I'm sorry, you see them? Okay. So here is a burst induced in one cell, and in fact, it can induce a burst in another cell. And these don't look like EPSPs. They're very sharp. They look like spikelets. Unfortunately, they didn't do pharmacology. But at least with the data available, it looks like these cells are electrically coupled, and the burst is propagating via gap junction, and the gap junction might be between the axons, although, of course, you can't really be sure from that data. All right, so now let me talk about gap junctions. Erin has already mentioned some of this data, and I'll actually show you some of the pictures. So there are several questions here. It is very well known that many sorts of interneurons are electrically coupled, and you can show that in different ways. One way is you can record from pairs of interneurons and make a slow voltage change in one cell and see a voltage change in the other cell. That's called DC coupling. I wouldn't say easy, but it's a very well-known phenomenon. In addition, there's electron microscopy of gap junctions between interneurons, and that works because, one, there are a lot of them, and also because those gap junctions tend to be large. So you can go in blindly, and you don't need to do immunostaining. You just go in blindly, and you see them, at least if you're Kosaka or somebody of that quality. Now, that has not worked with pyramidal cells, so it's legitimate to ask, one, are pyramidal cells electrically coupled at all? And if they are, what are the properties of this coupling, and where is it occurring on the cells? So this is a nice demonstration. I mean, I showed you the Wang data. This is a nice demonstration from Alex Thompson's lab that they are, at least some pyramidal cells, really are electrically coupled. Not DC coupling is not very noticeable, but transient AC coupling is obvious, at least in the right pair. So here's a spike in one cell making a spikelet or a little spike in the other cell. And here's actually a spike passing from one cell to another. And notice the latency. The latency here is a fraction of a millisecond, which is just right, just what you want for very fast oscillations. So there are electrically coupled pairs of cells. Doesn't tell you where they're coupled. Now, based on the Andreas Dragoon paper, some of those authors, so it was Dietmar and Andreas and me and John Jeffries, we published a paper in Neuroscience in 1999. But if you want to read about this, I recommend Tim Lewis and John Rinzel, which is much easier to understand and clearer. But the idea was this. If you have a spike that can propagate from one axon to another, and if each axon is coupled to more than one other, then you have something sort of like the model of an interictal burst that I just showed you, and you should get a wave of activity. I think Aaron called it a target. Was it a target? Topological target, okay. Now, it's not immediately obvious from that how you would get an oscillation in the whole network. It's easy to picture, you know, a target, a spreading target, and the way to think of it is, first of all, when two of these targets meet, they can't pass through each other because of refractoriness, so they meet and coalesce, go off in different directions. And the other is that you'll have repeating targets if there's some background of spontaneous activity. And depending on the rate of spontaneous activity and the rate at which the waves spread, that will determine or help to determine the frequency of the oscillation. So in any case, that's all fine if the cells really are electrically coupled by in such a way that spikes can propagate. So Dietmar Schmitz, who's now in Berlin at the Charité, undertook a very careful examination of this question. And one of the experiments he did was to record in low calciums, block synaptic transmission, and stimulate in regions where the axon collaterals of these cells run. And he would stimulate at very high frequencies and see spikelets that follow the stimulation one to one. So these are active potentials. They're too fast to be passive. They don't rise as fast as a full action potential, but they're still very fast and without failure. So this is dendritic spiking is not going to occur at these frequencies. Dendritic spiking occurs usually at a few hertz, maybe 10 hertz. So he did some other experiments to prove, or at least to support the idea that these were coming from axons. And this is the most convincing. This is a simultaneous recording of a soma and an axon in the same neuron. And when spikelets occurred, he showed that the spikelet appeared first in the axon and then in the soma. So it really was coming from the axon. Did it involve gap junctions? He did that by manipulating intracellular pH and diminishing the spikelet by acidifying the cell, which he could do through the pipette. And he also did pharmacology. So this is all suggestive evidence. It's not direct visualization. Now, I just want to digress for a second. Why is gap junction pharmacology hard? So this is an image from cardiac gap junction channels that have been expressed in tissue culture. So this is the lipid bilayer of one cell, M is membrane. This is the membrane and lipid bilayer of a nearby cell. And this is a gap junction channel making a tunnel. And this space here is the gap. So some cells form tight junctions where the membranes actually oppose against each other. In this case, that's not happening because these proteins have peptide fingers that extend out into the extracellular space, and they're binding to each other by van der Waals forces is what makes the tunnel, but it also creates this gap. Now, the point of that is that the tunnel is a tunnel. So if you have a molecule that's sitting in this extracellular space, it can't get into the channel. If this were a synaptic channel, and say an NDA channel, and you had a drug here, it could actually get into the channel, or if it was a voltage-dependent channel. So this helps me to understand why gap junction pharmacology is such a pain in the neck. So drugs that are going to affect the channel seem to do so either by some subtle alteration of conformation here, or they get into the cell and then indirectly somehow modify the channel. And that seems to be structural. I don't know what one could possibly do about this. It's just the way gap junctions are. So this is a paper that Aaron mentioned. This is the actual anatomical demonstration of a gap junction, which is this pink thing, on a mossy fiber. So this is a stereo view. This is done with freeze fracture, and the technique is you have antibodies to a gap junction protein called connexin 36, and the antibodies end up being complexed with gold beads, which are these black things. Actually, they're two-sized gold beads. They're little ones and big ones. And the point of doing that is the gold beads will show up at low power when you do EM. So you can go sort of scan through lots of surface area of tissue, and you find collections of gold beads, and then you can zoom in and look at the structure. And this is actually the complex of channels. If I remember, there were 100 or 150 of them, and you can show that they lie on an axon, which is this would be the axon here. And this is done by, I don't really understand this very well, this is done by tilting the section at different angles. This is John Rash who does this kind of thing. And then this is, I think Aaron may have alluded to this. This is the dye coupling data. So this is done by Sebastian Schuchmann. So again, this is light microscopy. It's not ultrastructure. So this is a pyramidal cell. It's been filled with a fluorescent dye. And by doing the confocal imaging repeatedly, Z stacks over and over again, it was possible to follow the dye out this thing and into this thing and into this cell. And these are both pyramidal cells because they have spines like this. And by light microscopy, these are axons. They have collaterals that come off at right angles and they have no spines. Now, not everyone is happy with this. There isn't ultrastructure here, and people think it could be some sort of artifact. I mean, I don't know what kind of artifact, but they worry that there's an artifact. Of course, EM also has artifacts, but that's another matter. Okay, this is Eberhard Buhl and that's Miles Whittington. And these are German colleagues. This is Andreas Dragoon and Dietmar, I've mentioned, and Hannah Monnier. Okay, so now I want to show that the rippling oscillation, the topological target oscillation, has certain interesting properties which are relevant to this meeting. So I want to compare the basic assumptions of this kind of rippling oscillation with the assumptions that went into the interictal spike. So before, we assumed each pyramidal cell is synaptically exciting more than one other, and that's what we're going to assume here too. It's each one's electrically coupled to other, more than one other, but not too many. In the previous case, it didn't matter how many, as long as it was more than one. Here it matters. Next, I want to assume that coupling is strong enough for a spike in one axon to elicit a spike in another axon at short latency, and that's consistent with Alex Thompson's data. And then if you put those two assumptions together in a sufficiently large network, you get oscillations. This is the field, this is the behavior of an axon, and this is what the soma is predicted to look like. So you see runs of spikelets and full action potentials. So now the question is, are these assumptions reasonable? So first of all, experiments show you can get rippling oscillations in cortical slices, not just hippocampal slices, when you block synaptic transmission. So rippling does not require interneurons, does not require chemical synapses of any sort. It's obviously can occur when synapses are present, but it doesn't require them. Now, another property that is predicted, and this I think is very interesting, is that the frequency of the oscillation varies five or sixfold as you change the coupling conductance, which to me says this cannot be a system of coupled oscillators. So it's certainly not weakly coupled oscillators because we have to assume strong coupling. It's probably not oscillators at all because at least in other experiments, the individual cells don't oscillate if you uncouple them. But in addition, you have this enormous variation in frequency by changing the coupling conductance. Now, why should that be? And is it true? So first of all, I want to convince you that this model is not completely insane, because at least the intracellular potentials look like what's recorded experimentally. Namely, there's a mixture of spikelets, these things, and spikes. And the frequency, if you increase gap junction conductance, as the frequency goes up. here in this simulation, I vary the frequency continuously and it goes up, but that's hard to do experimentally. So this is a plausibility argument. So now I want to make a digression on what we call Glissandi. So this is what I think is a new kind of EEG epilepsy phenomenon. Mark Kramer knows about already. So a glissando is a musical term, and like with a harp, if you take a harp and go brrrm, that's not very good, but the idea is it starts at low frequency and goes up higher. So here's a time frequency plot. This is a spontaneous event starting at 30 or 35 hertz, and it goes up to 125 hertz over about 6 seconds. And this is from electrocorticography data just prior to an electrographic seizure. So that looks very like that. Looks very like that. Now this is resected human tissue. So tissue from that patient was removed at surgery, and Mark Cunningham then studied it in vitro conditions, and he also saw Glissandi. So it's occurring spontaneously, no drugs. So here it's going from 20 to 100, and 25 to 120, and so on. Seven examples of them. So this is something that can occur. Why it doesn't occur all the time, I don't know. But Miles Whittington set out to develop an in vitro model to at least have an idea of what might be going on. And the key observation was that these Glissandi can also occur when chemical synapses are blocked. And the way he would do it, here it is in the time frequency. The frequency range is about the same as in the model. It does go to higher frequencies, but it's approximately the same. And what's happening is he has a slice, he blocks chemical synapses, and he takes a little pipette with lye in it, you know, sodium hydroxide or some god-awful stuff, and he puts a drop on the slice and it diffuses. If he records right where the drop is, he doesn't see anything. But as this alkaline stuff is diffusing through the slice, it's presumably opening gap junctions. We don't have direct proof of that, but we assume that's what's happening. And you start to get the oscillations, and they get faster and faster. Why do they get faster? Well, one reason, and I think the main reason, is that because alkaline pH increases the conductance between axons, the time it takes for a spike to go from axon to axon should go down. So this is just a simulation showing what is would be obvious to you. And then this is a simulation of the network as the gap junction conductance is increased over an appropriate range of nanosiemens and the field frequency increases. So we think this is what's going on. And to me, this is the best evidence yet that these kinds of network phenomena really are related to gap junction and cannot be explained with synapses. Now, putting this together, how much time do I have? Okay. So I try to put this together as fast as I can. In the very second or third slide, I showed how the rippling oscillation and the sharp waves were superimposed. And this is a demonstration of that in three different techniques. So this is data from a patient who had a temporal lobe focus. It wasn't showing up on the scalp, and so he had foraminal valley recordings, which sort of gets an electrode near the base of the skull and can pick up activity coming from the anterior temporal lobe. So this is a wideband recording, and you can see these transients, these interictal transients. If you filter it above 80 hertz, you get this, and if you look at the time frequency, every time there's an interictal burst, there's a burst of high-frequency activity. So this is just another demonstration of that same phenomenon, which I think is generic or universal. So here, this is in the foraminal valley. This is now tissue from that individual in vitro. And then this is a model. So the model is the same idea as 30 years ago with the synapses, but with gap junctions added as well. And it's to make the point that they can work synergistically so that you can get synchronization on tens of milliseconds timescale from the excitatory synapses, and then you can get the superimposed fast oscillation. And then the pharmacology, which was done on this human tissue, is consistent with this picture. I wouldn't say it proves it, but it's consistent. Now I want to show you some spatial patterns. This is another sort of test of this way of thinking. Again, this is to make sort of advertising. It's to show the correspondence between model cell firing patterns and observed firing patterns. That's human data. This is rat data. Again, its chemical synapses are completely blocked. Alkaline conditions, this is what Miles Woodington uses. You get a burst of fast oscillations here. This is the cell, spikelets, then full action potentials. This is blown up, spikelets, spikes, and then this is the model. The model now is some thousands of pyramidal cells, electrically coupled, nothing else, and that's what it does. So now how can we study this? This is what Tim didn't talk about. Which I was hoping you would talk about. This is Nikita Vladimirov made this picture, and just to show the principle of some spontaneous event and then spreading and spreading. And what I want to do is make some connection between a model of that sort and human ECOG data. The problem is to do that, the human data involves some big cortical region with, hundreds of millions of cells. I don't know how to simulate that many cells. Certainly not with lots of differential equations. So we used a cellular automaton model in which the axons are sort of quiet or firing or refractory, and you can then simulate lots of them. And there's some interesting or not so interesting physics, which I won't go into. Anyway, this is the kind of spatial patterns you get. So this is what's produced because the waves spread and they coalesce and go off in different directions. And with a characteristic spatial scale, what you get are blobs of a certain size and a certain frequency. Now this is milliseconds here. So you'll see little dots and little blobs, and they get bigger and they coalesce. And you see very similar kinds of things in the ECOG data. Unfortunately, I like this picture. Unfortunately, this is only one patient. This is just showing the temporal compression. This is a Bourjaki sharp wave ripple with the ordered pattern of cell firing, this unit firing, recapitulating this pattern of unit firing during exploration. This is theta here. So here are the rats exploring. The time is seconds. You get this ordered pattern of firing. Here you have a quarter of a second, and you have a very similar pattern of firing. So this is the replay I was talking about at the beginning. And then this is the big puzzle for me. This is the big puzzle. So here is a sharp wave ripple in vitro. Here, sharp wave, 200 hertz oscillation. If you look at spikes, this is apparently a normal phenomenon. You look at firing of cells during this, the spikes are antidromic. This is coming off a deep hyperpolarization, and it's inflected. You can hyperpolarize the cell to minus 80 millivolts. It still fires. You can get spikes like that by stimulating the axons. So there's information processing is occurring during this event, but the spike is coming from the axon. How on earth can such a thing happen? Now, you could say, all right, so I'm going to cure epilepsy blocking gap junctions, blocking fast oscillations. Everything's cool. Well, no, because, no, this is normal here. This is epileptic human tissue. It's filtered, so you're not seeing this wave, but there is a wave. Here's the ripple. These spikes are also antidromic, and you see spikelets, which is another indication of axonal activity, and these kinds of events also can come from deep hyperpolarization. So this is a real puzzle. How are we going to use this to actually make a difference for patients if it's a normal phenomenon? And what is the difference between the normal and the disease state? That's my plug. I'll leave that there for the next hour. And I want to thank IBM, NIH, this is the Bernstein Center in Heidelberg, Miles, Andreas Hanna Gabriel, the Alexander von Humboldt Stiftung, the Einstein Stiftung, and many people whose names you probably recognize. Nancy, Mark, is Mark here? Yeah, Mark. Mark Cunningham, and so on. So thanks very much.
Both you and Aaron mentioned that this is an ocular phenomenon, which I agree with.
At the network level.
Yeah. See, both of you implied that oscillators should be in one neuron. But if we think of...
No, we don't imply that.
Yeah.
We imply the opposite of that.
No. So that's right. But if we think of a network as oscillating, to me, that's where I start as an oscillator. I never assumed that it should be in one neuron.
Right.
So hence, I don't see this perspective as any different than oscillator theory, as distinct from saying...
But it's completely different because the individual cells don't oscillate.
No,
so how can you apply it? Okay, now so explain.
We don't care about individual cells. That's what I'm trying to accept and then to say.
Yeah.
Now, why I'm saying that? Because then later on, we still need to find out how those different regions interact with each other. In that sense, then we're talking about a chunk of cells, I don't care how many or what they are, would be some oscillator. And then another chunk is another oscillator.
Okay.
And
no,
we're
okay.
talking about the interaction between them. That's where oscillator theory, at least in my head, is. Never in the context of individual cells.
No, but the problem with that, I mean, I sort of agree, but the problem is you have to be able to account for the frequency of the network oscillation. And it doesn't depend on the time constant of any synaptic conductance, and it doesn't depend on an intrinsic time constant, at least not in any simple way. So where does it come from? It comes from properties of the noise and of the topology. So these are properties which are not considered in any oscillator theory that I've ever seen. And unless you can really specify where the period comes from in physical terms, you can't understand how different regions are going to interact with one another. So you somehow have to come, you have to get into those details. Okay.
In the context of neuronal mode.
Okay.
Martinus Marmorales introduced the concept of neuronal mode some time ago, in the 1990s. So now we're saying that what we have is this chunk of cells will be producing what I would call some of the neuronal mode that are transmitted to the next chunk. That is where we will accomplish something along that in General Lens in 2010 and 2011. Not just our group, but as well, Sinian Kalitkin and the Finrod group are talking about that. It's those kind of chunks. We both use four chunks to represent hippocampus. And then the question now is, how do they interact together? And our answer for that is through the neuronal mode.
Yeah, but a neuronal mode is a sort of mathematical expression.
No,
but what do you mean? No, but what is it? Okay, no, but what is it physically?
In terms of that, probably you can understand is something that the firing rate of a person neuron are proportional to something else.
Okay.
So the firing rate is being represented as some manifestation of neuronal mode.
Okay.
It can be represented as proportional to some function, its derivative, its integration,
Yeah, I mean, I guess I just am too used to thinking concretely. I want to know how that comes about. Because, I mean, I've talked about this with Lopez da Silva. Lopez da Silva, as soon as I say gap junction, his brain switches to someplace else. So it's like, we can't communicate about this kind of thing. So, yeah, Yvonne?
The interneuron couplings that are very prevalent, right?
Yes.
Gap junction coupling, and those are mostly to dendrites.
Yes.
And I wonder if you know about this paper about three years ago by Nelson Houston.
Yes. Yeah. So it's an interneuron axon.
Yeah.
That one. Yeah. Nature Neuroscience. Yes.
And the reason I mention this is because so those are, of course, very special cells in that the axons are very dense, extremely dense, that's why they're neuroglia.
Yeah.
So there's something about the axonal architecture there that, you know, makes it possible that when you fire these guys, a single cell at very high frequency repeatedly, right?
Yeah.
And after a while, they become self-sustaining.
Yes. Yes. Well, this is sort of what one of the things Aaron was talking about. if gap junctions are close to the soma, or if they're far from the soma, very different kinds of things can happen.
Yeah,
beyond that, we don't have data. So, by random, you mean are there hubs, for example, or what's the spatial scale, or?
Axon, and there, I think everybody would agree that those spikes are coming from from the axonal field.
Yeah. Yeah. What is it? But what wasn't clear, or maybe I didn't understand the paper enough, was whether this is a collective phenomenon. Could you explain all the data just by what's happening in the axon of that cell, or does it require other cells? So I wasn't sure about that.
Dirty drug.
Okay. So, but what did they block? Okay. So they're okay. That's. Yeah. So Dietmar Schmitz has some other data in the 4AP kind of protocol that suggests there might be electrical coupling between interneuron axons. They weren't near glioform cells. I should say they weren't identified, but we don't think they were near glioform cells. So it may be,
yeah.
Okay.
So you can reproduce that too. So then if you have polarized terminals, then you can actually block the spectral propagation of the axonal action.
Okay, so that means this ectopic spikes may actually be coming from the terminals. Yeah. Okay. That's reassuring. Well, that's what happens in gamma oscillations, at least persistent.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, so it's with persistent gamma, it is like that in that the field is, you know, going like this. And if you look at individual pyramidal cells, you know, they fire here, one fires here, one fires here. But the reason for that, I believe, is that these somatic firings are completely irrelevant to generating the oscillation. They just occur. It's actually coming from the axons driving internons. But that's another lecture. Oh, they are. No, they definitely are.
You don't need to have a pacemaker cell.
No, there is no pacemaker, right, there is no pacemaker cell. As far as we can tell, there's no pacemaker cell. I don't know, maybe you should choose the...
You showed me in one of the pictures that the axons do search each other.
Yes.
What is the possibility that the short system, the bigger section, the gap section, the search?
So whatever the distance is, the extracellular potential is microvolts. It doesn't matter what the distance is. What would matter for the distance might be some kind of a capacitive cost. But what you want is a spike to go from one axon to another axon. So what kind of extracellular potential would you need to do that? So, I don't know, 10 millivolts, you know, something of that order. So somehow we have to imagine such tight compartmentalization of the extracellular space that there's a huge, that it's really isolated, that you can get such large potentials. So I can't say that that's impossible, but I just can't picture how it could be with any picture of the extracellular space that there is. What I can imagine is that there might be other kinds of junctions, like tight junctions, which would allow capacitive coupling. So it doesn't really involve the extracellular space. It's just a capacitive jump. And if it's in a small branch and if there are enough sodium channels, maybe that could work. But then you have the problem of pH changes. So, you know, this is very, very reproducible, and I don't see why pH would alter capacitive coupling like that. You know, so. I'm following a line of what I think is maximum probability rather than certainty. You understand that?
Okay. I just like understand something. The spike was that you described, the axonal coupling, they're large, very large. You've also described spike was much smaller.
Yeah.
Could they also be in part anadromic partial spikes?
Yeah, they are. No, that's what they are.
That's
what they are, yeah. Yeah, no, these so-called spikelets can be a fraction of a millivolt up to, I don't know, 30 or 40 millivolts. So, and they all look more or less the same, but they're very variable in amplitude. Yeah, that's right. Yes. Yes.
So I cannot help. I come to this conclusion. So the propagation of the pulse in the nervous system is independent of frequency. Is that the general principle?
Who said that? Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, you go ahead. You go ahead. So the only data that's coming to mind at the moment is which may be not what you're thinking of, but it came to mind anyway, so I'll show it. This is something that Rodolfo Linos likes to talk about. So if you have the cerebellum, you know, it's folded, and then you have an inferior olivary cell, and these cells have axons that go to the Purkinje cells. So these paths have different lengths, but the propagation time is constant. So this is an oscillatory system. So somehow the conduction times get scaled in such a way that this time, you know, to here, to all these places, however, is constant, which allows this folded cortex to follow the inferior olive tightly. Well, the frequency of this oscillator is variable depending on conditions.
You have different length of the path, right?
Yeah.
And the time to propagate is constant.
Yes. I don't know that the frequency dependence of that time has been looked at.
Okay.
I doubt it, but I'm not sure. But I would guess that it is. But I don't know for sure.
Looking at your signal, yeah. You have, say, you have 200 hertz signal.
Yeah.
Imposed on, like, 3 hertz.
Yeah.
Like a large amplitude. And they keep the phase coherent, right? When
yeah.
you measure that, it doesn't really move around to signal. So it's phase coherent.
More or less. Yeah.
It must be.
Yeah.
Your picture.
Yeah.
So that means I have to draw a conclusion that the pulse propagated is independent of frequency. That's the only way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't see any other way. If frequency dependent, then your signal going to, you know, move around, right? And you can see a nice, beautiful picture.
Yeah.
All the way. So.
Okay.
And I don't know, is a general principle or nobody thought about
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't know the answer.
You don't know that.
No, sorry.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.